three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 040871, General Electric Company, Tarrant County Limited Partnership, and C.B. Richard Ellis versus Arthur Lee Morris from Tarrant County and the Second Court of Appeals District. Justice O'Neill is not sitting in this cause. 050016, Mid-Century Insurance Company of Texas and Texas Farmers Insurance Company versus Shefkat Adanan from Henderson County and the 12th Court of Appeals District. Justice Heck is not sitting in that cause. And docket number 050645, Allstate Insurance Company and other related insurance companies versus Sevilla Fleming individually on behalf of all other persons similarly situated from Travis County and the 3rd Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these arguments, and the court will take a brief recess between them. We expect to complete all three arguments before noon. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 040871, General Electric Company versus Arthur Lee Morris.
May it please the court, Mr. Hayes and Mr. McGarry will present arguments for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 6 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Hayes will open with the first 9 minutes, and Mr. Hayes will also present the rebuttal.
May it please the court, Mr. Johnson, Mr. McGarry. My name is Steve Hayes. I represent the respondent, General Electric Company, in this case. Mr. McGarry represents the landlord defendants in this case, also respondents. We have decided to structure our presentation to the court around four questions, which the Supreme Court update distributed to the appellate advanced appellate seminar this fall said this case presented. I'll address the first three. The fourth is peculiar to Mr. McGarry's client. The first three questions that I'll present, and I'll give a short rendition of facts after these. Whether an employer can be liable to an independent contractor under a premises defect theory when the existing defect is open and obvious. Second question, what constitutes control over an independent contractor's activities in the employer-independent contractor context? And the third question is whether plaintiffs can claim that their injuries arise out of both a negligent activity and a premises defect cause of action. Very short rendition of the facts. Mr. Moritz was the employee of an independent contractor that GE hired to deliver conduit to its customers. He was injured at the warehouse that GE ran when he fell from a ramp. He was injured as he was strapping down the load that was already loaded on his truck. He fell when his strap, which he was pulling on and leaning backwards to pull on, broke. And because he was standing on the ramp, he fell backwards onto the pavement below. He complains now.
Mr. Hayes, let me ask you. I'm having a little bit of a difficult time visualizing this ramp situation from the briefing. It wasn't real clear to me. Is this like a walkway ramp?
This is a ramp, and actually there are pictures of the ramp in the record between pages 373 and 378 in the record. However, for the court's edification, and this is in the landlord's motion for summary judgment, the ramp is about as long as the court's bench. It's about 10 feet wide, curb to curb. There's a toe curb on each side that's about 4 inches high. The ramp is 4 feet high on one end, roughly. It's a few inches over that. And then it goes down to ground level on the other end. And the end that's up here at this end, the elevated end, abuts directly into the opening to GE's warehouse. So that's the deal.
You say toe curb. You mean elevated curb on either side of the ramp?
Yes, sir. It's about 4 inches tall. I don't know how wide the curb is. It's sort of like a regular curb. Mr. Moritz complains about the lack of a railing on the ramp. The lack of the railing, is an obvious defect. It's an apparent defect. He claims it's not hidden. It's not concealed. He was blatantly aware of the lack of the railing. Subjectively, he said that to him it was open and obvious, as was the danger associated with not having a rail on the ramp. And he had even complained to GE in the past about not having a rail on the ramp.
Was it up to him how the materials were unloaded? Or where at the point?
That particular day, what we would do is we would distinguish between the loading of the materials and the strapping down of the materials. That particular day, there were probably two places where he could have parked the vehicle and loaded the conduit on the vehicle. One was the ramp where he did, in fact, park. The other was on the level ground beside the ramp. He chose that particular day to load at the top of the ramp. The loading of the vehicle, by the way, was complete when his accident occurred. He testified to that. He pled that in his petition, and he was in the process of secondarily strapping down the load. As a matter of fact, that's really about the only factual assertion, excuse me, in the Supreme Court update that I would take issue with, because the court's update, or the Supreme Court update, said that he fell while loading the truck. The loading was over. The reason that makes a difference is because the undisputed evidence is once the load was in his truck, it was his responsibility. That's the testimony of Donnie Morris, who's a GE employee. It's his responsibility when, whether, or how he straps down the load at that point. Mr. Moritz also testified that he could have driven his truck before strapping the load down, could have driven his truck off the ramp a distance of about 40 feet and gotten on level ground before strapping down the load. And it was his strap that broke as well.
So what do we do with Parker versus Highland Park?
Parker versus Highland Park. This kind of came into focus for me, I think, when I was listening to the oral arguments in the TXI versus Perry case. And about 12 minutes into the respondent's oral argument, actually about 10 minutes into it, Justice Brister, you had asked a question about the concept of a hurricane blowing through and the landlord not having time to fix the problem and the tenant going ahead and encountering it anyway. It seemed different to you. Justice Heck, about 2 minutes later, commented that it seemed that a number of the problems that arise in this area of the law seem to come from an overreading of Parker. I think that's, in fact, what's going on here with Mr. Moritz's approach. He does not take issue, and I'm getting to you, he does not take issue with our argument in our brief that Shell Oil versus Kahn confirms that, generally speaking, the duty of an employer like us or a landlord, an occupier of the premises, are the same with regard to a premises defect. That is, if you have a concealed defect, you have a duty to warn, you have, or exercise reasonable care to try to fix it. But you got to have the concealed defect first. Parker. Parker, in fact, when I went back and reread it, it's a concealed defect case. What was it? What was the defect that Mrs. Parker tripped on? It was the second step on that landing. Did she appreciate it? No. The court's opinion reflects that she didn't even remember there was a second step there. Was it concealed? Yes. She didn't see it. Her brother-in-law, Judge Massey, was doing everything he could to try to illuminate the steps. But because of the configuration of the banisters and the way the steps were configured, he couldn't illuminate that second step. And the landlord, which had installed lighting in the stairway, but the stairway was dark, the landlord had control over that lighting to the exclusion of the tenants. And the lighting was on a timer, and it couldn't come on until a couple of actually came on after Miss Parker's accident, but before she was moved away to the hospital to have medical conditions. So it looks like to me, under the Shell Oil versus Kahn articulation, you look at that situation and you say, is there a concealed defect? Yes, there is. What is it? It's the second step on the landing. It's dark. What's the landlord's duty? A duty to warn or use reasonable efforts to make safe. Did it warn? No, it didn't. Did it take reasonable efforts to make the step safe? No. As a matter of fact, it shut the lights off and had those lights rigged where they could not be turned on. I don't know. Mr. Moritz might argue that Ms. Parker had a warning. The only warning she had was from her sister, who said, Ruth, be careful. That's no warning of that second step. That's just the general admonition that one sister gives to another.
Well, that would work, except that Parker itself says that it was open and obvious. That's the whole reason for the holding Parker was to do away with that idea.
It was, but when you look at the first enumerated reason that the court gives for eliminating the no-duty rule, the open and obvious rule, what the court says it's doing, and the court says that it's got a problem with open and obvious and no duty, because it said it criticized the no-duty rule as contributing to confusion in the area because the appendage of the no-duty concept to a plaintiff's burden to prove that a defendant owed a duty creates confusion in this area of the law. It didn't eliminate the burden of the plaintiff to prove the duty exists in the first place. It just says if you have them do it once and then you have them do it again with a twist, that's more than they ought to be doing.
Can you tell, you cite the O'Sullivan case, can you tell what the state of the law is in the country at this point?
I cannot tell you, Judge. Other than what's in the briefs, I can't elucidate on that, no.
The idea of foreseeability and which party is in the best position to avoid an injury not only comes up in the duty context, but it also can come up in proximate cause context, a la Falsgraf, as we know. Yes. Proximate cause was raised at the Court of Appeals. Was it raised here?
I would have to go back and look at our briefs again to be sure, and I don't want to misstate that. That's not something I focused on here. I believe in our petition for review we talked about causation. At the trial court level, we talked about proximate cause in terms of foreseeability. Could we foresee that this person would use this? More specifically, could we see the person would use this strap in this way at this location? Strikes me the proximate cause argument is really one of would a warning have done me good and it wouldn't have. That's not specifically addressed at the trial court level. Did that answer your question?
Yes or no?
I would have to go review the briefs. I simply do not remember, Judge, and I apologize for that.
You're going to talk about control.
I am. I'm over my allotted time. In terms of control, once again, we think that we have to realize that the only control argued by Mr. Moritz in his brief in this case is the control of the location for a non-injury-producing activity, that is, the loading of the truck. That's it. He says there were four places I could park to load. Two of them were taken up. That left where I parked and on level ground. They controlled where I parked to load. The loading was over. And that's clear. And it's clear that he was under control of strapping down the load, and GE didn't have any control over that. As a matter of fact, Donnie Morris also testified in the record that he never had the opportunity to talk to Mr. Moritz about how he strapped down his load, whether he used straps, ropes, or not, anything else. Recently, in Fifth Club versus Ramirez, this court reconfirmed all the general tests about what control is sufficient. And the court talked about that the general had to control the method and manner of the details of what the independent contractor was doing to the point that the independent contractor did not control those methods and manners anymore, and that the control had to relate to the injury-producing activity. We think that the court can decide this case by focusing on those elements. But if the court sees this as collapsing the two activities, loading and strapping, we would point out that the only control Mr. Moritz talks about is the control over the strap. I mean, control over the loading, rather. Control over the loading. And in Fifth Club versus Ramirez, the court said this before it reiterated all the standard tests on control. It said, an employer can direct when and where an independent contractor does the work, but an employer may become liable only if he controls the details. This is strictly the only control he talks about is where. That's it. And that's our point. I'm way over my
Thank you, Mr.
time.
Hayes. The court will hear from Mr. McGarry.
May it please the court, Mr. Johnson, Mr. Hayes, clerk. My name is Richard McGarry. I have very, very limited time to address the court on the issue that is peculiar to my client and Mr. Hayes cannot address, and that is the issue of control over the ramp, because that is an issue that we are somewhat adverse upon. That's why we have split the time today. If the court has any questions, given the limited time, I'll be glad to field those questions and respond to them. But as far as my client is concerned, they are the landlord of the property. As a matter of law, a landlord owes no duty to an independent contractor or a tenant in a leased space. There has to be an establishment of an exception of some kind. The burden upon of establishing that exception rests upon Mr. Moritz.
And Mr. Moritz points out in his brief that the lease says that the common area includes parking areas and the loading facilities, and that it says all common areas described above shall at all times be subject to the exclusive control and management of landlord.
That is correct. The lease does, in fact, state that. The fact of the matter is, though it is undisputed by Mr. Moritz's own testimony, the ramp was not a loading ramp. This is a ramp that's a dock ramp. It goes up to the dock to give a vehicle access to inside the warehouse space where you can do whatever you need to do inside the warehouse space and depart. Mr. Moritz stated that it was specifically for the use of a forklift to go out of the warehouse space, down onto level ground, pick up what it needed to pick up, and go back. There is also the expert testimony of four experts who testified similarly. This is not a loading ramp, ergo, it is not a loading facility.
What kind of ramp is it?
It's a vehicular access ramp, and it is designed specifically to NATSA standards. It's why it is 10 feet wide. It is why it is not quite 4 feet tall, and there is a 4-inch curb, toe curb, on either side.
I'm somewhat confused about the ramp, and which ties into a question that Justice Wainwright asked. How would this ramp, whoever controls it, whether it's this type of ramp or some other ramp with or without a railing, how would it have prevented this accident?
The ramp or the railing?
Both. I mean, if the strap broke, seems to me that was the proximate cause of this incident.
Well, Your Honor, the proximate cause was not addressed by me in trial court at all. And I have a humorous story about that, but I don't have time to go into that. The issue about the railings, the issue in front of this court is whether the lack of the railings is a dangerous condition existing at the time Moritz entered the property, independent of the action of anyone else, and was concealed. Justice Brister, in an opinion by the name of Kukas, I can't remember the last, but the Kukas opinion stated, lack of handrails is not a concealed danger. Again, as a landlord or an owner or an occupier, if I have a duty at all, which we say we don't have a duty because we didn't control the ramp, if I have a duty at all, it is either to make it safe or to warn of concealed danger. This was not a concealed danger in any way, shape, or form.
And how was it unsafe?
I don't think it is. I mean, it's a 10-foot wide ramp. Nobody is alleging there's something wrong with the construction of the ramp, that there was a hole in the middle of it that caused you to trip, stumble, do anything going up the ramp. It's 10 feet wide. It's big enough to park a 250 truck. And I've grossly exceeded my time. And I appreciate your questions. I hope I've answered them.
Any further questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Junta will present arguments for the respondents.
May it please the court. My name is Frank Junta, and I have the privilege of representing Mr. Moritz, who was the injured person in this case. March 16, 1999 was a day that changed his life. This case is about an environment and a work environment that had two specific issues. There's questions regarding control, which I'd like to address. This particular ramp is 36 feet long. It is approximately 10 feet wide, and the curb is actually 6 inches high, and it's 1 foot wide. The testimony of that curb was to prevent vehicles and forklifts from leaving that ramp unintendedly. This particular ramp, by virtue of the lease, and paragraphs 9 and paragraphs 11 specifically give control to the landlord for that particular maintenance and all of the features that a landlord would want to have in controlling that particular ramp. When GE assumed that lease, they had the lease premises inside the demised walls. Everything outside the demised walls was in the control of the landlord.
What was the concealed defect here?
The concealed defect, Your Honor, in this particular case is really relative to the people that were working on that particular ramp or walking on that particular ramp. This ramp was an ingress-egress leading into the warehouse. There was a garage door, and vehicles could access it, forklifts could access it, and also people would walk into it. They would have the choice of using the ramp if the door was open, or they could use the door adjacent to the right, go up the steps, and into the office. What is concealed to one individual may not be concealed to another. In this particular case, the focus of the work activity was selected by GE. My client, when he arrived that day, was told where to go. He was told where to park. Yes, there are four areas where he could load. This particular day, the loading dock to the right, which did not have a ramp, could have been loaded from the door.
But doesn't that go to control and not concealed defect? I think, as I understood the question, is what was the concealed defect? You're talking control, are you not?
Well, I am addressing control, but the concealment issue that was addressed or the question presented, from our position, Mr. Moritz, in working on the truck and loading the truck at the direction of GE and to secure the load, which was part of the control process, from part of what he was supposed to do to secure the load, his focus is on the truck. His focus is on the load, which is his job and what he was paid to do. As he is focused on that, the particular environment that he was told to work on, that particular ramp did not have the railings.
I was thinking that I remember somewhere in the briefs, didn't he testify that if he was behind the truck, he thought that was all right? If he's on the side of the truck, he thought that that might be dangerous?
The reason he did testify that, Your Honor, the reason is he backs up on the loading ramp. The angle of the ramp is approximately 30 degrees, so the back end is right at the opening where the garage door is and the level surface of the warehouse floor. So all of the loading is from that area of the warehouse into the back of the truck. The securing of the load and adjusting of the load can be from either side of the truck. So you would be exposed to the ramp on the either side of the vehicle when you're either adjusting the load or securing the load. Now the actual apex of the triangle, the very highest part there, is exactly 4.5 feet. So the concealment is when you're focused on that particular work environment, and that's what your job is, you're unaware of the environment that could cause potential issues. The question became is how would the railings prevent this particular injury?
Well, let me be sure I understand. I thought your position was it doesn't matter whether it's concealed or not under Parker, even if it is.
That is my position.
Even if it's was clear as day, which looks like it probably was. It was obvious that there was no rail there and that if you lost your footing, you could fall off.
That is true, Your Honor.
But you think you win even if it's not concealed?
I think we win because a jury could consider his position and what he was told to do in the work environment he was placed to work in versus what GE was doing, and that could be a consideration of is it open and obvious because you appreciate it, much as in that case with the open hole that didn't have a railing on it, but it was still determined to be a defect? Or do you make the environment safe on a foreseeability basis? In this particular case, to address the question of how does the railing prevent this injury, because this bungee cord breaks, because GE says that was unforeseeable, but in that particular day it did, the rearward force propelling him, he goes up against the railing, he stops at the railing, I never meet my client, and we're never here.
He may break his back on the railing. Other things could have happened to him as well.
That is true, Your Honor. I couldn't say that he couldn't receive an injury there. My thought process is, though, the injuries would have been much less than falling off 4.5 feet, fracturing his pelvis and breaking his thumb.
And we might still be here.
Possibly. I couldn't say that, but my thought process is that the railing would have prevented it. There are six ramps in this particular warehouse complex on Beach Street east of Fort Worth.
Mr. Junta, you said a jury could have considered the extent to which your client appreciated the dangers or did not and could have made a call here. Isn't the duty inquiry one for the court?
It is, Your Honor. I think the duty
is... Are you arguing duty or proximate cause?
It is a matter of duty, Your Honor. It's obviously a question of law, but it has to be based on the facts.
Then how do you get to a jury on a duty issue?
Because the duty issue...
If the facts are not disputed.
Well, the facts are a little bit disputed, Your Honor, with regard to the open and obvious issue and to the level of appreciation and obviously the control issue. The duty is one of control and is determined by who had control over the work activities. The issue in my particular position is that the control by GE, in that they selected the environment, they selected the location, they directed Mr. Morris where to park on that particular day, and he followed that directive. Typically, he would be loading inside the warehouse. On that particular day, there was merchandise blocking that particular entryway. So,
I thought that, maybe I'm wrong, but I thought that the record indicated, at least in the briefs, that he chose where to park that day. He was not directed to the ramp.
That is not true? My recollection of the testimony, and I am the trial counsel. I did all the depositions, and I was there for everything. And the testimony of Donnie Morris, the warehouse supervisor, is that he would direct the individual where to go. Now,
On this particular day,
and just let me back up, Mr. Moritz had worked for GE for some time. He was their preferred driver. So when he would arrive that particular morning to get his work assignments, he would typically drive into the warehouse if it was open. On this particular day, he did not because it was merchandise there.
Right. So every day is going to be different, right?
It could be.
Sure. And so this particular day, again, as I remember what the brief said, that he couldn't remember anybody directing him to any particular place. Am I correct on that?
He may have testified to that, Your Honor, but the testimony of the GE people is that whatever the work activities that were going on that particular day, not just with Mr. Moritz, there were other people that were picking up materials, there were other materials that were being delivered, depending on what the particular work day was. On this particular day, the ramp was, by GE's own admission, the easier place to load the vehicle. Now, there was a comment that Mr. Moritz could have gone down to the parking lot and done that. Well, that's impractical because the forklift would have to come down from the warehouse, down the ramp, load into the parking lot. There would have to be people carrying things down. It was just typically impossible.
The merchandise that we're talking about here, the conduit, was that just placed out on the dock for him to load onto his truck on his own, or did somebody from the facility help him with that, or how did that work?
The latter. GE personnel, the warehouse personnel, would load the materials, and I think Mr. Morris would help, would load them into the back of the truck. In this particular day, there was conduit, which extended out the back of the pickup. I think it was 10 foot long, and the bed is only 8 feet long. And there was wire and other materials and boxes being loaded on. So these materials are being drawn from the inventory by various GE personnel, either placed at the back of the pickup to be loaded in by GE or Mr. Morris.
Okay, so once it got on the truck, though, then GE had no further responsibility.
Well, that's an issue. Mr. Moritz preferred to secure his own load, but the load would have to be secured before you typically would move the vehicle.
Well, if he preferred to do it on his own, then he obviously was not being directed by anybody how to load it.
Well, specifically, the direction of securing the load may not have been the precise wording, but he had a responsibility to make sure that the load was secured and safe on the vehicle for transport. Typically, all of the loading, all of the securing would be done while the vehicle is stationary at the time it's being loaded, because it's just impractical to move it to another location to do that. You're loading it there, you may need another person to assist. In this particular case, Mr. Moritz chose to use an additional bungee cord to assist in securing the load. That was the preferred way that he wanted to do it, and GE liked it because none of his materials were typically damaged when they were delivered. He was requested to be their delivery person, and he continued to be their delivery person until March 16, 1999, when he no longer worked. But I think that the issue of the environment and the control of the environment is very specific with regard to these two particular defendants.
Why shouldn't the rule of law in a case like this be that if the defect is open and obvious, there is no duty? If it's open and obvious, it's fine.
Because what is open and obvious leaves room for a lot of conjecture. And what may be open and obvious to one individual walking up that particular ramp and in a work environment may be different from another.
Well, it's a reasonably prudent person standard.
I think a reasonably prudent person standard would apply.
And the fact of the matter is, are we going to run society assuming everybody's going to act like a reasonably prudent person? Are we going to run society at a level for the biggest idiot to protect them from doing idiotic things? Not that you're not directed to your client, but I mean, if that's not the standard, then in fact you have to make all premises safe for reckless people, don't you?
I would think that the duty, which is the law as I understand it, that it should make the premises reasonably safe for reasonable and prudent people doing reasonable and prudent things.
But if it's just a reasonable standard, then don't reasonably prudent people always avoid open and obvious dangers?
In certain circumstances, they would. It depends on the environment that they are in. In my particular case, the situation was Mr. Morris was working at an area that he was told to work, but focused on his truck, focused on the activities with the loading and the focus of securing the load. The remaining part of the environment can be a potential danger in the foreseeability of someone falling off. If Mr. Moritz fell off while he was loading a box, would that make this case any different? If he was falling off while checking the air in his tire, would that make the case any different? I mean, I see railings in this.
Would be any different if he just stepped off the ramp accidentally, off the warehouse floor?
Well, there was testimony that one individual did do that, and it possibly could be, depending on the circumstances.
Do you think after Parker, just what's your view of this, after Parker, do you think it's possible for the occupier or owner of the premises to get a summary judgment?
Yes, I do.
How?
I believe that, depending on the facts and circumstances, that our full argument could say that there are circumstances that are so obvious to the situation and the work environment that was appreciated by this particular individual, whatever he was doing, or she, possibly could be something that someone would absolutely know. I think the testimony...
But if one person's... It looks like you're always going to get a swearing match because the plaintiff is going to say exactly what you just said, which was... Well, I didn't step off because I want to kill myself. I wasn't looking. But they should have had a rail or something or to protect me.
Well,
and if he says that, then it looks to me like you've got a trial.
Well, when you think of it fundamentally, and you say what's open and obvious, it's just like saying, you know, what's good quality? I can know that I can define it, but I know when I see it.
No, that was pornography. That was pornography.
Well, open and obvious has been around for 100 years.
It certainly has, and I'm not disputing that.
And the question is whether Parker was right. Is it different that Parker had no choice? I mean, your fella had a choice, according to Mr. Hayes, of where he stopped and pulled on the strap.
I dispute that he had a choice. Mr. Moritz was on that premises because he was told to be there, invited to be there to deliver GE's products. Once he gets on that premises, he is told what to do and where to do things. I have not had the privilege of being in this room and arguing for this court. I check in. This lady says, "Do you know where to sit?" I said, "No." She said, "You sit over here." I sat over here. So... the choice is relative to the circumstances.
But did they instruct him, Mr. Hayes' point is, may have instructed him on what to pick up and where to load, but they didn't instruct him on how to secure the load in his own truck.
That is true, and most artisans do things. I mean, what GE is asking this court to do is to stratify the particular work activity to say some is in control and some is not. I don't know how you do that as a general policy if the General Electric Council is being asked to advise their warehouse people. What do we tell our people?
Well, but in open and, you know, if it's a reasonable person and open and obvious, and we decide as a common law court what duty is, we may adopt one rule for little old ladies visiting their in-laws at an apartment house and another rule for working men that are moving heavy equipment in and out of warehouse. I mean, you can't, obviously, a loading dock can't have a rail on it because then you can't load stuff.
I take issue with that. There are six loading docks in that particular complex. Two of them have railings. There are expert testimony.
I mean, but I'm talking just one without a ramp. If you just have a loading dock to a garage door, the whole idea of a loading dock is you back up to it and load stuff straight off the truck. But if you have a rail there, you can't do that.
These particular garage facilities had two loading docks, one with a ramp, one without. When an 18-wheeler or a bobtail truck would back up, the height of the truck floor bed would be level with the warehouse floor. That would be one way to do
it. And you wouldn't want a rail on that because then you couldn't do that.
Well, it would be impractical to have a rail at that particular moment.
Right. But somebody, without a rail there, somebody is going to be looking over the other way and fall off somewhere in the country off that ramp. And so, but your theory is every time they do, we just let the jury decide.
I'm somewhat confused. Are you talking about the actual ramp location?
No, or one without a ramp.
Okay.
Because your rule is going to apply whether there's a ramp or not.
My rule would apply in this particular case.
I mean, it's whether if there's no ramp, open and obvious, there's no rail, versus there's a ramp, open and obvious. It's going to be the same rule for both of them. They're either going to be open and obvious or not. And on one of them, where there's no ramp, you back the big truck up and load it straight off into the warehouse, you can't have a rail.
In practicality, you wouldn't have a permanently affixed railing. However, I've gone to many of these warehouses where they have an accordion gate, and they pull it across, which is 3 or 4 feet high, so that people wouldn't inadvertently walk off. You pull it back when you're going to use it. I see that all the time. And I don't know about this particular warehouse. I've only been to it once.
Remind me, does OSHA require a rail on this?
Actually, it does if it's over 6 feet. It did not.
So the answer is no.
Yes, sir. It is.
Your client testified that he didn't like to load on the ramp because of safety problems. They asked him his specific safety concern about the ramp, and he said falling off of it. How do you get to a jury, even if the open and obvious standard is subjective, when your client has said, I know the danger and the risk of loading on the ramp and strapping on the ramp?
He was incredibly honest when he testified.
Incredibly honest?
Incredibly honest.
As opposed to simply honest?
He's rare to be committed.
he did testify to that. He appreciated that in the circumstances. Said,
sure.
You know, if you told me to load here, to load somewhere else, right, prefer to do something else, maybe. And that particular day, he said, we got to get you loaded. You got to get this stuff to the contractor site. We've got four other trucks here. They got to get loaded. And he did it. Has he done it before? Yes. Has he loaded on that dock before? Yes. Yeah. Did they want him there? Yes. He was the preferred driver. They wanted him because he took care of their goods and made sure that they got there safely.
And let me be sure I understand. We got off on control there. But you think you win whether his activities were controlled or not?
As to the landowner, I do, yes.
But not as to GE?
As to GE, I believe that there is a control issue, that they control his work activity that cannot be separated or segregated to say just as the loading is one phase and securing is another or driving up is another.
If GE did not control, did not have the requisite control that we're talking about, then your position is that you can't prevail against GE.
Probably not unless I can show detailed control. And my position is that GE is incorrect in trying to slice the work activity and to say we've got control on this, we've got no control on that. And as a practical matter, I don't know how you apply that as a general policy.
But you think you prevail against the landowner whether there's control or not?
Well, I do. I think I have to establish control on the landowner, and I think I do that, and it's clear from the lease. Paragraphs 9 and paragraphs 11 clearly give the landowner control. If GE wanted to do something to that ramp without telling the landowner, Mr. Powell, the manager, I assure you C.B. Richard Ellis would be at GE's door and say, what are you doing to our ramp? For sure they would do that. And that was the argument I gave to the trial court. GE says they don't have control of the ramp. Landowner says he didn't have control of the ramp. I said somebody's got control of the ramp.
Let's get back to
when we're talking control. You're talking GE's control over the work activities, landowner's control over the premises.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So when we're talking control, you're separating those two.
I am separating from negligent activity to the premises.
GE is control over the work activity. You lose if there's no control. Landowner is control over the premises, construction, the rails. You lose against them if there's no control over that. But you're not saying the landowner controlled the work activity.
I do not say that.
So based on the testimony of your client that I read, you acknowledge that he appreciated the danger, correct?
I'm saying that he had noticed that there was no railings there in a situation where he had to park on that particular day.
Let me rephrase it. You acknowledge that he understood that his safety concern was that he could fall off the ramp.
To
use his language.
He did testify.
But you think in this case, that doesn't cause you a major problem because of the circumstances.
Because
he was focused on loading, not falling.
Exactly. You have to look at the totality of what the circumstances were. In this particular case, on this particular ramp, loading on these particular materials. And I think his focus on that work activity and what he was doing in his job and what he was asked to do focuses on that part of it, and the fact that the environment may have other issues that could cause a potential injury, and there could be other things that could have gone wrong. The parking brake could have failed.
Does the appreciation of this danger equate to the assumption of the risk that goes with the danger?
I think, well, assumption of risk has been abrogated, of course. I think in listening to my client and knowing him, and what the work environment was in his testimony, I think a jury would clearly understand. When you look at our model of the ramp, clearly understand what the circumstances were. And I can think of hundreds of situations where environments are that could be potential issues that you appreciate and you know, but you do it. I mean, you could do the obvious of saying, I'm going to get in an airplane and fly back to Dallas, and something could happen to the airplane. Could you foresee that? Sure. Are you not going to fly? No. I'm going to do what I have to do. So I think in this particular case, you need to focus on the totality of the circumstances that Mr. Mortz was in and understand that that particular work activity was directed by GE from the moment he stepped onto the premises to when he left.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Mortz.
If this had happened in the dark, wouldn't it be exactly Parker?
We're assuming that my client or the landlord, one of the two, would control the lighting situation.
Right. And,
no, because once again, Mr. Moritz, there's an objectively the railing is not there, that's objectively fine, and Mr. Moritz not only subjectively appreciates that lack of railing and the danger associated with it, but has also announced that appreciation to my client.
You say the difference is when Mrs. Parker did not know of the problem with the step, Mr. Moritz knew that this was going to be a drop-off.
Yes.
Would it make any difference, do you think, if the drop-off were a long ways?
100 feet. I'm scared of heights. To me, 4 feet is 100 feet, which it's a real joy to watch me climb a ladder to change a light bulb. But the danger is there, the magnitude of the danger. He said that he appreciated the danger of falling. And
of course, on the other hand, I recall being told at the Grand Canyon that nobody's ever fallen off the edge where there is no railing. The only place people fall over the edge is where there's a railing because they feel safe and going up the rail and hanging over the rail. And so at some point, our safety measures encourage people to pull on straps when they wouldn't risk it if it was a fall.
Perhaps. There's a whole science on human factors analysis that I won't pretend to be an expert in. But
OSHA doesn't require a rail.
Apparently not. No, that's what's in the record. Not trying to move away from the question. I did want to mention to Justice Wainwright, I went back and looked at our petition and our brief, that
the causation that's brought up. Page 11 of our petition, page 20 of our brief, we talk about his knowledge and appreciation of the danger, the lack of running into danger would vitiate any need to have a warning. Well, that's how we put it. That's how we phrase it.
This gentleman was brutally honest in his testimony. What if he testified he did not appreciate the danger?
If he didn't appreciate it, that doesn't change the objective standard, I don't think, of is it just apparently not there.
Well, that seems to make it more like Parker if that was his testimony.
If it was like Parker. If he testified, no, I wasn't aware, I didn't know about it, I didn't see it, it you know, wasn't there, then that does make it closer to Parker, I think.
Well, then if you have someone testify that's not completely honest like this gentleman was, and got a different fact scenario, obviously, and maybe we're not here.
Well, I'd still say, while it's closer to Parker, it's still not Parker. Because in Parker, I don't think you can get away from the fact that when I read Parker and when the court talked about darkness and when I looked at the counsel involved in the case and Coit Mock, who I knew a long time ago, and John McBride, who represented the defendant who, before he went on the bench, was a fearsome adversary. I bear the Bible.
Well, even so.
You can say that, I can't. But anyway, but I got the impression that the argument was that the darkness was the defect. The darkness wasn't the defect. The darkness was one of the conditions that made the defect concealed. It was concealed. It was objectively concealed. That she didn't know about it means she didn't know about it, she didn't remember it. And that was one point the court was trying to make. But it's still objectively concealed when you got the darkness there.
Should there be a different rule for apartment houses and workplaces?
I don't know. I'm sure there are those that would argue that it should because of various policy reasons and studies that have been done. But what we do know here is, you know, Mr. Moritz was at that facility every day for a year and a half. He was as familiar with that loading ramp as my guess is Judge Murray and his wife were with the stairwell outside the apartment where they live.
Then why can we trust jurors to apply different standards to little old ladies' apartments versus guys working?
I don't have a problem with that, but I think you've got to prove the duty first. And the duty requires a concealed, in this case, on this set of facts, which the court determines as a matter of law, you have to determine the duty first. And to get to the duty on this particular analysis, you have to have the concealed defect. And we don't have that here. And there's not a reason to go back to the standard where you had the granulation of the issues and the jury had to find every single one of them, and whether it was concealed or not concealed. That's here, objectively, it was not concealed. The third question that I was going to try to address that was mentioned in the Supreme Court update had to do with can you plead negligent activity and the premises defect. Great law story from law school. I won't get it. I don't have time. I think they're mutually exclusive when you look at the test, but here you don't have a premises defect case. So this is not the case to say that you can't have both.
Are they mutually exclusive if you only have one defendant? Because his position, this say he only sues GE to start with, he's claiming negligent activity. If he only sues the landowner, he's claiming premises defect. So what is the difficulty with his position?
With his position in this case, as to the landlord, he doesn't have one because he does only allege the one cause of action as far as I know. With regard to
GE. He just said in his oral argument just a moment ago that as to GE, he's claiming control.
Yes.
That has to be negligent activity, right?
Yes.
And he's only claiming premises against the landowners.
He is, but he's also claiming premises defect against GE.
Okay, well, if he's now taking those positions, what is the problem with being able to take those positions in one lawsuit against separate defendants?
You've given me some time to tell the law school story. Very short.
You need to ask the chief about that.
Well, yeah. Chief,
it's very brief.
It is. Two students standing in the library. They're 2L students.
And everybody in the world has been dying to meet this one attractive 1L student. And she comes up to one of them and says, can I plead this cause of action? And one of the 2L says, oh, you can plead it, but it'll be dismissed for want of subject matter jurisdiction. Conversation ended. You can plead it, but the question, I think, is can you plead a viable cause of action? I mean, you can put the two things in the same pleading, but does it get beyond that? And I guess that's what I'm having a hard time seeing. If you put it in the pleading, will it withstand a motion for summary judgment? Both of them in the same case. I don't think it will, because here, and this is not the case because this is not a concealed defect case, so you don't have a premises defect.
Further questions?
We thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.